Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Steve and I cover The Spoils of War. We're more than halfway through Season 7, and Steve absolutely loved this episode. This was one of his favorites. This is where Dany and Jon have a little chat in the cave, and Littlefinger and Bran have a conversation. Arya returns to Winterfell at last. This is also the episode where Dany plus Drogon plus Dothraki attack the wagon train. The scorpion is revealed, and Jaime in full armor sinks to the bottom of the river. Okay, without further ado, here is comic Steve Osborne. That's a pretty great episode, man.
It is real good.
It's a really good episode. And I remember being impressed because of the way it ends. You know, Dany attacking, with Drogon, the Dothraki, that scene was just fantastic. And it kind of overshadowed my memory of how great of an Arya episode this was. Like, everything going on at Winterfell was super awesome.
Right.
And so it was sort of like the awesomeness of Dany attacking the convoy really eclipsed my memory of really how great the rest of the episode was.
Mm.
So the rewatch, like you had told me ahead of time that you were watching a little ahead of me, and you were like, that's a pretty fantastic episode.
Yeah.
And so I thought, oh, I remember it being kind of a cool little set piece, but I really don't think I remembered how awesome this one was.
Well, and there's so much going on, and I am a fan of the idea that King's Landing is broke.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think that that's such a cool...
Well, and we've known that for a while. I mean, we've known that since... I don't know, season one, really, when Ned comes and finds out that King's Landing's broke.
Yeah, but I just love the idea that that matters in the story.
Yeah, that's
right. I mean, because it would matter, and it's so easy to get caught up in all the other stuff, and then that becomes so like grounded in reality that it's kind of a necessary grounding in reality because there's so much magic going on now, right? I mean, compared to when we first stepped in. We've just gotten used to dragons. We've gotten used to the undead and resurrections and smoke babies and necromancers and all this stuff, right? We're just used to it now. Mm. So the idea that they're like, we're out of money, it kind of brings you back, right?
I mean, it's just really basic stuff.
Well, because in a way, like, that's life, right? We try to fill our lives with what we consider magic. Mm-hmm. But there's a price. And so here we are. And White Claws ain't free, baby.
I think it's one of those things where, like I said before, this show is really sort of complicated and intricate, and at times it can just really play with some very basic real life stuff. Like, why don't we eat people? Like, things like that. Like, what happens when you do run out of money? Or what happens if the queen's an alcoholic? Or whatever it is. It's like basic real world stuff that makes you think, it's actually kind of complicated if you run out of out of money. You're trying to wage war without money. That's a problem. And so they're just trying to get the money. They're trying to get the money from Highgarden to King's Landing.
Right. Which is such a, like a, and which is, again, when you look at the whole scheme of everything, and this is where the Tyrion, it seemed like maybe he miscalculated, but he also didn't, you know, which is interesting because he was in charge of the money, right? So,
well, what he learned from Littlefinger was you just put the numbers on the page and everyone's pretty much happy,
right?
And then you just keep borrowing from other people, which has kind of come due this episode. It's like Cersei's finally like, I'm gonna need another loan, but if I don't pay off the old loan. It could be really boring stuff. It absolutely could be really boring stuff. But they play it up pretty well.
Yeah, no, they did that really well. And so and it's kind of nice because there's a lot of it feels like we're in the middle of like kind of a prize fight right now, right? In a certain way, right? Like, because like The Lannisters, the King's Landing thing has been a little bit more rope-a-dope right now. You know, hey, no, no, don't take Castle Rock. And so all the energy starts going to Castle Rock. You know, but then all of a sudden in comes Danny and company prove that they're heavyweights. And so it's like, all
right. Well, that's right. Rope-a-dope's a great way to put this, because what's happening here is that Cersei doesn't have the firepower, right? She, if Danny wanted to take King's Landing, and everyone has said it like, you know, 10 times this episode, she could just take King's Landing. But in order to do that, she's going to have to burn the place down. And on the she's got the army, she's got all the firepower, and then Cersei's like, you know, I really need another army. So Danny's basically giving her time to go buy this Golden Company army, and she's got to, you know, she's got to get the money, she's got to get the loan, then she's got to ship the army from across the sea. This all takes time, and all of Danny's advisors are saying, wait, 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 right?
Right.
And then I suppose she's kind of done waiting.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, that's Lady Olenna's advice, right? And that's sort of a direct...
All right, I'm glad you mentioned Lady Olenna's advice, because we didn't talk about this yet, but does Danny want Lady Olenna's advice? By her own admission, Lady Olenna is basically a revenge monster, or at least she was right up until she dies.
Sure, sure.
All she cares, I don't think she really cares about Danny. I don't really think she cares about anything. I think she's kind of a nihilist at this point, and she just wants to see Cersei burn. And so when she tells Danny, be a dragon, I kind of feel like maybe that's not the best. Like, everyone else is telling her, like, no, no, be the ruler that people will want to live peaceably under.
Mm-hmm. And that's true. And I think that but here's the beauty of what the Lady Olenna advice does, is it echoes, right? It echoes enough. So whether it's good advice, whether it's sound advice, whether it's built on revenge, or if it is even maybe an element of Lady Olenna saying, hey, look, I've been doing this for a minute.
Yeah.
Look, I'm old and I'm alive at this point. I might
have. All the men giving you advice, ignore them.
Right. Or at least, I get the sense too that she's like, look, that's all great. That's all fine and good. However, I interpret it a little bit more like there comes a time when being a dragon is the right move. You know, now Lady Olenna may just be like, hey, always be the dragon. But I think that there's this element of she plants the seed. I think there's some truth to the idea that it says, look, you can be too patient in some of these cases. You can outthink yourself.
Yeah, don't get too cute. You got dragons, use the dragons.
And then, so add to it, all right, I've done this slow play strategy. I've lost a good chunk of my ships. Mm-hmm. I have a bunch of soldiers in a place that apparently isn't necessary. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, you know, I'm, you know, that gives me time to be wooed by a weirdo who wants dragon glass, but like this. So it's like, at some point you're just like, I'm sitting on three dragons, you know?
Yeah.
And I can go right now and take out a good chunk of the Lannister army and, you know, and cripple them at the same time. Why don't I just go do that? And then so then this scene happens, and outside of the scorpion weapon, looks like the right call. You know what I mean? I mean, so she doesn't know that that's there. So there, you know, and it's not like Tyrion was like, don't go out there. There may be this great weapon. Nobody saw that coming. Mm-hmm. So that one is so that part is like on. That's just kind of the way war works. But, you know, in the meantime, She's bum rushing the show. Now you can say, okay, you've made your point. Go back. Because Tyrion's thing was like, look, yeah, one arrow to you, and this whole thing is all for naught. So, you know, I think there's a sense of proceed with caution, and you know, you got to know when to fold them. And at some point, you say, look, I've torched a lot of people. I've torched their provisions. I'm out.
Well, and I think that. Let's say Tyrion and Varys and Jon Snow have their way. The best way forward is for Dany to just show an overwhelming amount of force without actually attacking, and for Cersei to kind of say, well, you win. I really don't have the troops to go to war with you. Here's the city. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think Cersei would rather die than get the throne. And on top of that, I think that there is an element of Tyrion that's thinking, like, war is horrible, and moreover, I'm going to war against Bronn and my brother and the people I grew up with, all of that business. And so I don't think that there's nothing to Dany's accusation to Tyrion. Right? Like, it's your family. And then you see the consequence of that on the battlefield. It's like Tyrion just... Having Tyrion observe that battle added a whole new dimension to it. Because he was just... The look of horror on his face at seeing, you know, people he grew up with, the Lannister army, all of that business, burning alive, that brought a whole different element to that battle scene.
Right, because now, so, you know, the scene, or the show ends with Jaime in, you know,
just sinking
in the water, right? Yeah, that's right. And but there was the added little bit of cliffhanger was, to your point, the aftermath of Tyrion witnessing that, right? Because Bronn and Jaime are fighting together, and they're fighting together because Tyrion kind of put him in that position. Tyrion,
it's kind of true. I mean,
in both directions, they're fighting this battle because Tyrion has basically, you know, say, hey, we're waging war against these guys, and he united them. That's his brother and like one of his closest friends, if not his closest friend.
Yeah,
and they're now fighting together because Tyrion put them in that situation earlier.
Right. He introduced.
So he's created the relationship, and he's on the outside of that relationship looking in. Who does he have? I mean, he's got Varys, but you know that's one thing, but he doesn't. It's one thing Tyrion does not that he did enjoy, not only playing the game, but you know, acquiring friends. I mean, he was good at that. He's one of the, like we've talked about that, one of the few guys that has genuine relationships with people. Podrick is out with Brienne. Bran and Jaime are together. I mean, him and Varys have a nice little rapport, and I think he genuinely likes him. But I mean,
if not for him, it could be that Dany and Jon don't get together. I mean, they may not even be meeting if it wasn't for Tyrion, because Tyrion's respected and liked by both of those two characters. So now
there's a certain ironic loneliness to Tyrion, because he's created these friendships and sort of created the notion of allies, not just for power's sake, but almost for camaraderie's sake. And now he's kind of left without. See that, so again, it was nice to have another, like, to have their return to kind of a Tyrion-heavy episode.
Yeah. Sure,
and the last two have kind of been that way, right, where we've seen him, you know, we see what it is we've missed about Tyrion. And so that the conflict of him watching the battle, it felt very genuine, and it adds a new level of concern. It's like, well, is this going to change his approach at all to what's going on? I tend to think,
I mean, it has to have some kind of consequence for him. The progression of the scene was wonderful because you go from Bronn kind of laughing at Dickon's name, right? So you've got this kind of, you know, you're in a pretty good mood because you're watching, you know, Bronn do his Bronn thing. And then all of a sudden it's like, I hear an army over the hill.
Yeah.
And so there's this ominous army thing, and then like everyone getting set up for the army, and you're actually seeing the army come down the hill, and you just, it's just like, just feels like there's 10,000 of them. And Bronn telling Jaime, you better get out of here, because these guys are going to rout us.
Right.
And then you see the front line where like the Lannister soldiers are like trembling in fear. So you're already feeling like these Dothraki are just going to wreck shop. And then on top of that, once you're sure that the Lannisters have no hope at all, then you see Drogon come over.
Right.
And that note, you know, see, and then you get the Bronn and Jaime freak out over the dragons, and that, just the sequence of all of that happens even before you know that Tyrion's going to observe this whole event. It's almost like an orchestra where you start out with sort of this wonderful bass line, and then you start building on top of it. That whole sequence was masterful.
And so here, if we take a step away from the actual action and just the sort of the our own reception of the show, here I am in season 7. You know, sure. Warnings abound. I'm buckling up for an inevitable bumpy ride, and I don't know. And like most things I read, say season seven is among like one of the low points, but not necessarily low point, but in terms of rankings, right? Yeah. And you know, again, if you like, let's just take the inevitability of season 8 off the table. If you have 8 seasons of something, and even if all 8 seasons are good, one of them's going to come in number 8.
Yeah, right? Sure. No, that there's no doubt about that, and you've experienced season 5 and come out of it, you know, you've survived it. You're like, yeah, actually, it wasn't that bad.
Yeah, I feel pretty good about season 5. Dorne aside, and again, those are the low points. And right now, I'll be honest, I have had less low points in season 7. Ed Sheeran is still better than most Dorne. So I think it's interesting because so far in season 7, and it is a truncated season, I feel pretty good.
Wait till they bring in Huey Lewis in the news in season 8.
See, now, what I would love is if it was just the news.
Don't take money.
And you know, Huey's not there. It's just the news. And they are dressed exactly the way they were in the Happy to Be Stuck with You video. And and I'm like, well, wait a minute. What? And like, there's a moment where I'm like, is that the Fabulous Thunderbirds? Cause like Huey's not there. So I'm not sure. And then they're like, no, that's the news. and they're
Huey
playing
was
and
doing the national anthem at a Giants game.
And they're playing the
show up.
They're playing the Reigns of Castamere. And so, yeah, season 7 so far has been kind of a pleasure. I mean, I'll be honest.
It's a great episode for sure. And
last episode. There was some pacing issues maybe, but overall I felt like where it was going.
I did, when I first watched this, I did think like, all right, it's taking Jamie forever to get from Highgarden to King's Landing, which makes sense. It's like, you've got these wagons, you've got this huge wagon trail. It's just going to take a while. That's what Game of Thrones does. It'll give you a realistic look at, you know, a character getting from point A to point B and, you know, shenanigans along the road, right?
Yeah.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Yeah, and I guess there's a, I guess because I, you know, and maybe this has something to do too with, again, the method in which I'm watching this, where I'm watching it, not real time with all these different, you know, the anticipatory glee and tension. There's this like, all right, on to the next one. Mm-hmm. So as the show, like, so there may be a sense, I feel the sense of urgency, and the show is in some cases giving me that same sense of urgency in return. Yeah. So, and again, maybe because I'm bracing so heavy for disappointment right now, that every good thing is great.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Sure.
And every great thing is magic. Cause yeah, sure. I mean, I walked away from this episode saying I'll hold this up against, the finale of Season 6 and Hard Home, to be honest.
It's a great episode. I don't know if it's that good, but it's a wonderful episode. And part of what makes this episode wonderful, Like, I think that the entire episode could have been focused on Winterfell, and I would have been delighted.
Agreed. I agree with that, yeah.
When Arya comes over the hill and, like, looks at Winterfell, it's just like there's this... Like, she's been through so much. And she's a totally different person. And it was sort of like you... It's one of these things where you can never go home.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. That's the kind of the feeling you kind of have. Like, you're coming home, but like, but neither the home nor yourself is the same.
That's right. That's right. And I thought that the exchange that she had with those, you know, idiot guards was pretty great. And Sansa, the cool reception of Sansa and her in the crypts.
Yeah.
I thought it kind of reminded me like, oh. These two actually have a history. Like,
they have a history.
They hated each other as kids, right?
And when they left, there was no resolution, and they were also so young when they left that there was no like the idea. Like, they outgrew the need for resolution because they never grew into anything else, right? I mean, with each other,
right.
So when they come back, it's like, oh, there's a lot that we never really dealt with, but also, I'm kind of over you. Like, there was that sort of feeling of like, you're important because we're Starks, but I don't know you.
On top of that, like, the only thing that Arya knows of Sansa is that Sansa really wanted to marry Joffrey and treated Arya like shit, like her whole life. And the last time she saw Sansa was up on stage.
Yep.
Next to Joffrey while their father's head was being chopped off.
That's true. Yeah, and then there was some there, and she didn't really stick up for her during the whole wolf sequence. And
exactly. Yeah, so, so I thought that they played that really well. It's sort of like, okay, yeah, they're hugging, but neither one of these two has forgotten the history behind this.
Well, and the other, and I think that was really good because I think there was an initial reaction here, like between Heather and I was like, this seems sort of like an understated reunion, but then it forces you to remember.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that that's a really a good way. Again, this goes back to like we talk about, in some cases there's the need for exposition, in some cases there's not, and sometimes they mix those two up. And this is definitely one of those where trust the audience to do the exposition in this exchange. And I think that's how I got it. And it was a perfect way to be like, look, you've done the work. Look at your notes.
Right. And I think that from Sansa's perspective, I think she's thinking, I really don't know this person.
Like, well, yeah.
This is a woman who somehow survived everything. And now she's like holding her own with Brienne.
Yeah. That was a great, I think that was so good because it was fun to watch, but it was also really, it was so good for, I love that Littlefinger and Sansa are watching this. Like, things are different. Like, again, this is this is not the Arya that left, you know, and her, like, what she, and again, if we've had this conversation about how Sansa's sort of this disjointed journey, like, is she getting it? Is she figuring it out? Oh, maybe not. Is she, you know, and then she's kind of doing some really good leadership stuff and Littlefinger is pouring on the flattery again. But then Arya comes in and it's kind of clear to both of them, oh, she got different. and intentionally different to the point where she, like, and if Sansa recollecting, hey, Arya wanted to be a warrior, and she's a warrior.
She ain't chasing cats no more. She came back as, like, Bruce Lee.
Exactly. And so there's this, yeah, so that is, talk about a complication and a, oh, maybe I not made as much progress as I gave myself credit for.
Well, also, Sansa seems to be keeping Littlefinger pretty close. Like, even though she'll diss him from time to time just to put him in his place.
She seems, here's the hope, right? And this is because
they're walking shoulder to shoulder. She's confiding in him. You know, could be keep your enemies close, but from Arya's perspective, it's like, why is Littlefinger here? And why is he your most trusted advisor? Like, this is...
Right. Yeah, so there's that. And because we still don't know, is Sansa smart? in keeping him, like, the enemies closer, or is she once again susceptible to to being manipulated? And we don't have enough evidence on either side right now. Like, I mean, because
it's crazy that we're in season seven and the jury's still out. You know?
And so now I'm starting to not necessarily like her character more, but like her, like where we've gone with her, because I'm now of the, all right, I think this has been intentional. And if it hasn't been, well, then it was a happy accident, as Bob Ross would say, because I'm very compelled, because when we see Jamie's conflict, you know, especially when he's with Brienne, it's like, we kind of know that, yeah, he's just a visit with Cersei away from being terrible again. But with Sansa, I just don't know. Like, I mean, Sansa could just as easily slice Littlefinger's throat as she could betray Jon. Where I'm at right now. And I don't know if either one of them would be from a position of agency.
Yeah. I mean, like, everything's awesome at Winterfell. Like, everything is, all of these different reunions and meetings, and you almost, the gang's getting back together in Winterfell. And the fact that Littlefinger's there just screws everything up, right?
Oh, for sure.
It's not just a fly in the ointment. It's like you let a vampire in the house, right?
Totally.
And he's cool, but at some point he's going to want some blood.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's just, it's just a brilliant setup. You know, how do they resolve it? Now, there was one thing that got a lot of fan reaction to that I want to get your take on. And it's like...
Cape drawing?
No. It's Bran.
Oh, yeah.
So...
Bran. Winterfell Stephen Hawking.
Bran is... Okay, so the fan response to Bran at this point was,
I do have a little bit of like, because Heather was like, "Oh, I really love the little Bran story," and I was always like, "Meh," and now I'm like, "Where's your Bran now?"
People were like, "Okay, he's super creepy," or "He's weird. He just got really weird," or "Bran sucks." You know,
yeah, that yeah. Was, so you're telling me there wasn't array. A big, like, there wasn't a whole, like, oh, thank God Bran is in this one.
Now, I'll be honest. I do appreciate Bran more.
Well, because he's doing something. He's not just being drug around.
I'll tell you what. There's a multiple reason. There's multiple reasons why I appreciate Bran. All right. In this episode in particular, one is, who is a match for Littlefinger? Mm-hmm. Pretty much Varys and no one else, right?
Right.
And then Varys sits down with Bran, and Bran has him made, like, within 5 minutes.
You mean Littlefinger sits with him, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What did I say?
Varys.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Littlefinger sits down with Bran, and within, like, 5 minutes, Bran has him made.
Yeah.
It's almost like Littlefinger feels like, I have no idea what to do with you.
Yeah, and that's the first time we've ever seen that. Because Littlefinger at least feigns he's in control. But because he does. He's always thinking ahead. And he's trying, and the advice he gives Sansa before.
That's right. He's imagine every scenario. Here's a scenario that he could have not imagined. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, what if a guy who can't move his legs knows everything?
All right, that's the other
thing. Like, I've taken everything into consideration, but I did not take into consideration this.
tree man. All right, so...
There's a tree man among us.
Here's the other thing about tree man. Tree man doesn't know everything. And that's revealed when he says to Arya, I saw you at the crossroads. I thought you were going to go south.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
and she
yeah.
says, well, so did I. So it's almost like, okay, we need limits to magic. We need rules for magic. Apparently for Bran, one of the rules is he can kind of see a lot of different situations near and far, but he can't see everything.
Right. And also, isn't it like he's saying he's getting it all kind of at once?
Yeah, he's kind of getting it all at once, but there are certain things he doesn't know. And I think that that's kind of important.
Side note, I did read something yesterday, and I don't know if this has anything to do with anything, but I'm fascinated by it. It says you don't remember things that happened Like, you don't remember, you don't like, you know, you don't remember what you remembered, you remember the last time you remembered it.
That's right.
And I think that's an interesting notion of, you know, as we start dealing with time, and he's kind of talking about how, like, he's remembering things that haven't happened in some regards, right?
Well, in addition to that, and it's totally true, like, you don't remember the original event, you remember your last interpretation of that. Mm-hmm. Bran says something that's really important that I think a lot of fans missed, and that is, I remember being Bran Stark, but I also remember so much more. And what I think that fans missed is that really this isn't Bran anymore, because memory equals identity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, to a large extent, right, you know, people keep calling him Bran, he's going to be Bran socially, right?
Sure.
But as far as sort of your internal perception of your identity, there's almost an equal sign between memory and identity. And if you remember 1,000 years of data, then the memories that made you Bran for the last 14 years or whatever, they're really insignificant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what's going on there is that when he says, you know, I'm not Lord of Winterfell, I really think he means, like, yeah.
No, I'm not Bran Stark.
And so, thank you for dragging me across the icy tundra for 100 years, Mira. But, you know, I'll send you a Christmas card, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and that was great. And I think, to me, that was the moment, right? I mean, that was the moment where, again, without the exposition, which I think in some cases helps, because this is a very complicated concept, but you're not really going to explain it too well. I think they've explained it about as good as you could in the, like, when he's kind of blowing her off, I'm like, this is not a guy who's under, like, mm-hmm. I wouldn't say he's under a spell. It's just like, well, he's like several different amnesiacs coming once.
That's right.
Right.
He's collective identity, right?
This is a Goldie Hawn on Overboard, like 1,000 times over.
So
like everybody there is like, you know, everybody there is Kurt Russell trying to explain to her that no, these are your children. This is yours now. And she's like,
it's interesting. I think that television movies has done a lot with like multiple personality. So much so that it's kind of like a trope, and, you know, people who actually experience, you know, identity displacement, it's not really how it works.
Mm-hmm.
But actors can kind of nail the personality, multiple personality thing, because that's what they do. They pretend to be someone else.
Sure.
And so as an actor, you can just kind of pretend to be someone else. But what hasn't been done a lot is for someone not to have multiple personalities, but have like this collective identity. And what does that do to someone? Well, it kind of makes them care a little bit less about their immediate family or the immediate conditions that they're in. And so you're asking Bran to kind of portray something that is really difficult to portray. At the same time, he is a little creepy.
Yeah. No, and I love the fact that he's, and I, the thing is the creep factor makes him way more compelling, you know, because
tell Sansa, he's like, I saw your wedding, you were beautiful.
Yeah.
He's, that's just not the right thing to say, dude.
Well, no, but then also like, and the other guy's like, ah, it's a real shame what happened to you that night. Like, it just kind of has that vibe to it. Like, that was a bummer, huh? But to me, all those moments, they speak such volumes to what he is now. And he's so like completely like exists outside of conventional morality.
Well, and this is the God problem, right? Because if my theories are correct, he's kind of becoming a tree God.
Mm-hmm.
Well, think about so let's imagine the more powerful a deity is, the less personal they have to be.
Right.
If everyone around you is kind of ant-like, how much are you really going to care about them?
Yeah.
So the more Bran is inhabiting, you know, 1,000 years of Three-Eyed Raven identity, the less he's going to be personable with the people that meant something to him, you know, 2 years ago or whatever it was. And so I think that the more godlike he becomes, the more weird he has to be.
Right.
He's something other than human, in other words.
Right. Well, in many ways, this is reflected, or this is sort of the manifestation of Tyrion's god critique, the Kthunk.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
And so there is an element of Bran that if you don't know any better, if you don't know Bran, if you don't know his story, you just observe them, you'd go, well, this guy's obviously, there's something wrong. He's a simpleton, you might argue, because he doesn't have what we consider emotions.
Yeah.
And the lack of emotion for us is to be less than human. And in this case, the suggestion is it's more than human.
So Tyrion talks about how, I mean, he doesn't say it directly, but my interpretation of it is that the gods are as impervious. The will of the gods is kind of unknowable, and they may not have a volition that's understandable to humans, and they may not care about humans, and they may not even know what they're doing.
Right, because they're so removed.
Mel's god is like, yeah, this god kind of does things that don't make sense. And
the best we can do is interpret it.
The best we can do is interpret it or ask for it. And sometimes this god will want a kid murdered. But maybe that was my fault. You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So the will of the red god is totally opaque. And if Bran is becoming something of a tree spirit, he has to become less human. And I think that's what this actor is trying to do.
Well, and Faith suggests that even faithful failure may still be part of a bigger thing that's beyond you, right? So, like,
well, it's what people of faith tell themselves.
Exactly, right? So
reset the ledger.
And that's the fascinating thing about Mel, and that's where the crisis of faith is, because Mel still believes that overall the end goal is there and that it's been revealed, but she does, it seems, recognize that she misinterpreted the Shireen sacrifice, which I think is fascinating, because she could easily say, you don't understand the bigger picture, I do, and then hope it pays off, right? Or, you know, but instead she's showing that that to me is one of the more compelling parts about Melisandre, is that, you know, she recognizes that something somewhere along the way got screwed up, and she's owning that, but she still has enough faith to suggest that, look, I still believe in this thing that's beyond me, but I also know that I might not have as much.
She's seen too much stuff to totally, you know, become an agnostic or whatever. But all right. So I thought, I mean, you're right. Wonderful episode. Everything at Winterfell worked for me. The knife, the dagger coming back into play, Littlefinger kind of being like, finally you see Littlefinger is at a loss, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, well, before, I mean, creepy meets creepier.
Yeah, before this episode, I thought, well, no one can touch Littlefinger.
Mm-hmm.
He is just too good at this game. Well, guess what's going to ruin the game? Someone who you can't keep secrets from.
Someone who's read ahead.
Someone who read ahead. That's right.
Well, and what's great about it is because they have put boundaries, and they've done so much with Bran by putting those boundaries on there. So he doesn't become this, yeah, I know, I'm going to tell you everything that's going on. Littlefinger's this. This is his grand plan. This is what's going to happen if you don't. Like, all that could happen. But because we get the sense that he's still on dial-up as the Raven, he's only getting so much information at a time.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. The other part of this is, so Littlefinger has a chink in his armor now, right?
Mm.
And so does Drogon. So we've actually seen that the scorpion works.
Yes. Now, we assume that there's more scorpions, because this one's gone.
Well, yeah. Exactly. You've got
at least they have the blueprints.
They know how to make more if this one's gone. But yeah, I think that you needed something like this to tell us that this isn't just going to be a rout. Like, Cersei actually has a weapon,
right?
That's going to make this kind of not necessarily a fair fight, but it's going to be a fight. You know, this is going to be a challenge. Yeah. because Danny just looks super, and she's got a, you know, a couple things that happen that don't work for Danny, right?
Sure. Well, and I get concerned because every time Drogon gets hurt, and it's been a couple times now, I'm like, man, if this dragon ends up dying over the wall, that seems like a problem.
What's that?
Well, I'm saying if a dead dragon gets...
Oh, over the wall.
Yeah. if the Night King and company come across a dead dragon, we've already seen they got some giants cruising along with them.
Now, this was a big fan theory because there was a rumor that the wall... Everyone was trying to figure out how the wall was going to come down because, you know, it's got magic in it. One of the theories was that in... baked into the ice of the wall,
it's magic, right? Is that what we
is the corpse of an old dragon? Like, there's a legend about it.
Okay.
And one fan theory was the Night King is going to like bring him to life as a zombie, and that's how the wall is going to eventually crumble.
Interesting.
And it may still come true in the books, I suppose. But a lot of people were on the sort of the, gotcha, the dragon inside the wall bandwagon for a while.
Interesting.
Anyway, so you're not too far off from a couple fan theories.
Okay.
I thought it was wonderful the way that they ended the episode because armor will just sink you. And a lot of these ancient battles, if ever you're wearing heavy armor, well, number one, like, it's not like a lot of people know how to swim. Not as many people know how to swim back in the day, but if you're wearing this armor and on top of that you've got one hand that's made of gold,
yeah, exactly,
you're not gonna be a strong swimmer.
It makes a great rudder.
I was a little bit like, how deep is this river?
I know, like, wow, he's going for a minute.
John likes to hook up with ladies in caves.
Yeah, caves is his jam.
Like, that's his kind of comfort zone. Like, if he can get the girl in the cave, it's like Fonzie's bathroom.
Like, I kept waiting for her to be like looking at the cave drawings, and then like he just drops a piece of chalk behind him as they walk out. See, they're real. Don't make it look too nice. We can't make it look too nice. It has to look ancient. Give it a blow. Just give it a blow. Look, I'm not a learned man, but here's one thing I know about antiquing cave art. Telling you, man, if you had told me like two or three episodes ago, it's like, hey, what if I told you that like Davos and John are going to pair up and be like a real important part of it? I'd be like, man, I don't know. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with it, but it's amazing how the show does it, right? Take this person away, add this person, keep this person, oddly enough. Now this person's with this person. You're like, how? I mean, I gotta give him credit. I mean, even if the wheels fall off, and I understand the wheels are gonna fall off. Yeah. And now I'm rooting for the wheels to fall off. Now I'm gonna be disappointed if the wheels don't fall off enough.
I like the callback with to Stannis. Like, they were walking down the steps, Davos and Jon. And John says, what do we have? 10,000 men less? And Davos says, fewer.
Yeah. That is awesome. That is really good.
He corrects John's grammar. You know, here's a guy who couldn't read a couple episodes.
That is so funny. That is great.
And I think that I probably missed Stannis correcting the, I don't know who it was. Was it Janos Slint or something? Someone up, Alistair Thorne or someone up the wall. He corrects their grammar from less to fewer.
Right.
And I just love those little moments that's like, I definitely wouldn't have caught that the first time around. I definitely didn't catch that the first time around. But on this time around, I thought, yeah, you've got history here. And you don't have to do much
to
remind me how cool this journey has been.
And I look, because it mattered enough. It mattered enough in the story. It also showed a little bit of like Stannis. It's like Stannis has got pet peeves. I like that. Right. I like the, because it does. It's amazing how quick, like, little thing like that rounds out a character. and makes him not feel. I mean, it humanizes him immediately, because you're like, oh yeah, that would bug me too, or oh, people like that drive me nuts. Whatever it is, you've now connected to him in such a simple way that carries over, and those kinds of things matter.
John says, that's right, it totally humanizes them. And John says afterwards, he's like, what? Like, you didn't quite hear what Davos has just said. And Davos is cool enough to say, it doesn't matter, right?
Right.
Like, he had to kind of say it just to get it out of his system. But he's not going to be a total dick and, like, correct, you know, be the grammar police for poor John.
Right.
I thought that was a wonderful. And on top of that, you do get the sense that Davos is like, hey, what do you think of Danny?
Yeah, I love that. I haven't told you the story about how I wish I had another set of fingers. It was recently as last night when I saw Danny, and I'm telling you right now, gotta jump at the opportunity.